Muddy Knees Media.
This news just in, listeners. The Athletic is extending its £1 a month offer for all new subscribers, meaning you can get unrivaled analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, plus a brand new breaking news service and ad-free versions of all of The Athletic's podcasts for just a quid. This deal won't last forever, though, so don't miss out. Sign up today at theathletic.com/totally.
Totally Football Show. Today, no idea either, frankly. One-way traffic at Old Trafford as Tottenham Hotspur put six past tottering hot mess. Then the champions get done 7-2. Can we call this one sloppy, Jurgen? As Ollie Watkins and co. rinse out the pool at the Villa. We look back on that and the other big stories from a crazy weekend. Hot damn West Ham with 4-0s and almost 4-0s at Leicester, and top-notch action and top-notch action too as Leeds show Man City how to football. It's the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Well, listener, thanks for joining us. Monday 5th of October. We're fresh from just another average weekend in the Premier League, really. We've got Daniel Storey in from The Eye. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, James.
Nice. Dominic Fifield of The Athletic is with us as well.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Dominic. Also, former pro baller Adrian Clarke, these days tearing it up in the analytics world. Adrian, lovely to have you with us.
No, great to be back. What a night to get a call up for this show. Loving it.
Wow. Yeah, what a day. I mean, the weekend, but particularly the Sunday, really mixed for people called Ollie, and really dark for Patrice Evra, who I think took it harder than anybody. But we'll come on to all of that business. Here's a tweet quickly from Paul McIntosh, who cites Danny Baker repeatedly insisting that this season is going to eventually be regarded with as much credibility as wartime football. Does he have a point regarding the many, many caveats? What do you think?
I mean, potentially in terms of the kind of haphazard quality and maybe the unpredictability of it. But I don't think it's any surprise that Danny Baker has sided with that being a negative. But I think for most people watching, that's a huge positive. You know, football is better when it's unpredictable. Football is better when everyone is tweeting like their house is on fire. So all power to it. I think it's brilliant.
Well, we all feared, didn't we, that football behind closed doors would be sterile. There'd be no tempo. The players wouldn't really be up for it. And it's just turning out to be the opposite. I don't know if they're losing concentration because they all think it's a practice game. They think it's just training or something. It's really, really bizarre. But we need it, don't we? Because as a spectacle without fans, it's nowhere near as good. We know that. So all you can hope for is a little bit of craziness and entertainment along the way. And boy, are we getting that. This is fantastic stuff and really, really well-timed from the Premier League. So well done all.
Phil Martin asking, is this season proof that people like me shouting man on from 80 yards away in the stands was actually really effective and ball-playing defenders struggle without our great advice? What explanation, Dominic, if any, have you arrived at today for what is going on?
I've been sitting here trying to work out why people have forgotten how to defend. And I sort of concluded in the end that I wonder whether we actually underestimated quite how important the time on the training ground doing the endless repetitive drills that Roy Hodgson and Sam Allardyce and the like apparently is their style of management and gets defences organised. And the reality at the moment is most clubs just don't have that time on the training ground. They're all recovering from the game and preparing for the next one. They're not actually doing the sort of mundane defensive drills that they might have done in the past. And maybe that has come into it. Maybe there's a bit of mental fatigue as well. I just wonder whether is it more mentally draining to be defending and having to concentrate all the time, or I presume that is, I mean, Adrian probably the person to ask. I mean, compared to, say, the press that the forwards are putting on these defenders, I mean, I imagine it's a drain for the defenders more, is it?
I think so. Look, you're speaking to someone that didn't do a great deal of defending. I was quite good at pressing. But yeah, no, when I did, it wasn't too successful. So no, but I think you hit on the right notes there. I really do. I think that because of the Carabao Cup games, the Europa League games and whatnot, they just aren't having that time to work on the nuts and bolts. And when you're just ticking over at the training ground rather than really going through things, and you can go through countless videos and you can analyse this, that and the other, and you can have a raft of analysts that go through all the information. But unless you go out there and practice, you do attack v defence day in, day out, then I don't think you can really nail it. And the teams aren't getting to do that. So, yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there.
Mm. Well, it was a weekend that was filled with scorelines that looked like they came out of the Carabao Cup kind of a late round when the big teams are desperately trying to find other things to do with the midweek. So many things to talk about. We're going to begin, of course, with Sunday night at Villa Park.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Jack Grealish is looking for another, and it is 7! The captain gets his second. This is a day of dreams for Aston Villa.
Listen, when last season ended, about a week ago, Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool were champions, and Dean Smith was almost relegated with Aston Villa. So Villa beating Liverpool today, can you think of a shock of the magnitude of this 7-2 scoreline, Daniel?
I mean, I think there have probably been bigger shocks. But I don't think there have been maybe more surprising humblings of a Premier League champion. It's the first time a Premier League champion has ever conceded 7 goals. And it's incredibly unusual for a Liverpool team and any defending champion to kind of collapse so readily against a weaker team. I mean, Villa have rejuvenated themselves over the summer. They have, I really don't like the phrase, won the transfer market, but they did at least do some very serious and very clever business in bringing in Matty Cash and Ollie Watkins and Emilio Martinez. And they strengthened in key positions without going for that scattergun approach that some have done and arguably they did last season. But no, I mean, nothing explains the kind of cataclysmic nature of beating Liverpool 7-2.
In a season of surprises, it's nice that one thing stayed constant, and that's when Jurgen Klopp announced Adrian would be taking Alisson's place for this one. We all kind of knew what would be coming, and it did.
What a way to start, 4 minutes in. I mean, dearie me. And his afternoon or evening didn't really get much better after that. I mean, we can talk about Liverpool's woeful defending, but they had 69% of the possession tonight and conceded 7 times, which is baffling in itself, really. I'd just like to talk more about the impact that Ross Barkley had on that Villa team. I know we always sort of focus on Grealish and he's been brilliant. He was brilliant again tonight. Watkins was superb. But Barkley should have been walking away with 4 or 5 goals to his name tonight. He was utterly unstoppable through that midfield. And that is the Barkley that Chelsea thought they were buying all those years back from Everton. And the Barkley, he just didn't fulfil any potential at all at Chelsea. You could argue he didn't get a proper run in the team possibly, but he just looked as if, I mean, he always tries to turn it on against Liverpool, but my word, he was unstoppable, irrepressible tonight. And it was great to see. And I think Gary Southgate will be watching that with interest from the outside.
It was a brave starting lineup to put him in there with McGinn as well and Grealish. And I think that's the word that I take away from Villa's performance. They were brave. They were playing the champions, yet they didn't worry about gambling on those forward runs. In fact, they relished the opportunity to make those lung busting runs and to test Liverpool. They were asking questions, weren't they? Ross Barkley was asking questions of the Liverpool midfield. Do you actually want to follow me here, or are you going to give up? And most of the time, they gave up. It was brilliant to see. As bad as Liverpool were, and as baffling as it was that they didn't change their tactics and they didn't you know, drop their line a little bit deeper and just tweak something. You got to credit Villa for the way they exposed Liverpool. They'd seen what Leeds had done to them. They'd seen what Arsenal had done to them when Arsenal were bold enough to make those forward runs, which wasn't often enough in that game. And boy, did it pay off. It was stunning from Villa. It really was.
Villa now on their best start since 1962 and 7 games unbeaten, stretching back to the end of last season. Daniel, is this one of those kind of early season blips when, you know, the minnows can upset the big boys before they get themselves sorted? Or are we witnessing a real revolution and the kind of Premier League pyramid being turned upside down?
I think probably a bit of both. I think there is an element of that, and Jurgen Klopp will be mighty relieved that, albeit plenty of players are going to all corners of the globe over the next 2 weeks, he does at least have an international break to I suspect, seriously look at whether this high line really works, because they haven't been picked off until now. But this was the kind of defeat that is bigger than itself, in that it sends a message to forthcoming opponents that, you know, try and copy this plan. It might not always work. And if Mane and Salah and Firmino are all clicking and all there, you might concede two or three goals. But if Liverpool had lost 3-1 tonight, you might say that's that. Conceding 7 goals to a probable bottom half team will send a message to the rest of the Premier League. And this is a season already in which there have been more shock results and odd occurrences than what we might normally expect in a full season. So I think it's a bit of both. I think, you know, exactly the same as with Manchester City, people now know that there's nothing to be fearful of any team they play in the Premier League now.
Yeah, I also feel that there's a lack of intensity from the Liverpool players. When you play, when you squeeze up like they do and try and make the pitch feel really small for the opposition, it relies on everybody doing their jobs and it relies on everybody working to the maximum. And I think maybe we saw Mane and Henderson, you know, their absences were really felt here in the way that they drive the team on and charge around. They just backed off a little bit. And when you back off and you still keep that high line, then it's an absolute recipe for disaster. It was so basic, because when I was a young player at Arsenal, and I'm sure most young professionals are taught this, it's one of the first things you learn is that if there's a real press on the man on the ball, you can squeeze up with a bit of confidence because that guy hasn't got time to pick the right pass. But if there isn't, if they've got time to look up, you go with the runner and you do not try to play offside unless it's the worst run you've ever seen. And for Liverpool to continually make those bad decisions just is a real head scratcher for me, because Van Dijk, it's not like they had a depleted back four tonight. They had a title winning back four tonight, albeit the goalkeeper was different. So yeah, it was really weird that Liverpool didn't respond and realise the mistakes that they were making.
Well, Jurgen Klopp got he sort of won a staring contest with Roy Keane last weekend after Roy used the sloppy word and about Liverpool's performance. But there's no other description really for this. And as you say, Adrian, the remarkable thing wasn't just that, you know, with the extenuating circumstance of Alisson being missing, that they did concede early, but that the reaction didn't come, the changes didn't come.
Well, no, yeah, I just think if something's not working, you change it, don't you? You might change the shape, you might just change the approach and say, look, lads, we're going to back off from the press and we're going to let them come on to us and we'll pick them off. But they just carried on making the same mistakes. In fact, they got worse. I know that Gomez was the fall guy, wasn't he? Not had a good start to the season, hooked on the hour for Fabinho to drop in. It didn't really get any better, did it? So he'll be relieved at that fact, no doubt. But yeah, it was just one of those days. I've looked at Liverpool a bit this season, and Van Dijk and Arnold and Gomez are just not the same players. They're not switched on mentally in the same way that they were last season. They will. They'll regain it, no doubt about it. But here and now, they're in a bit of a daydream. And yeah, it turned into a nightmare, didn't it?
I also wonder if it's an easy theory to make after a game they've lost 7-2 with a backup goalkeeper, but it probably shows just the difference a goalkeeper makes, not just to, you know, to stopping shots and even to the kind of possession football and short passing that we've seen over the last few years, but just the amount of confidence it breeds in a defence. You know, Manchester United are a far better defence when David De Gea is in form. And that, you know, he doesn't necessarily affect those defenders, but just in their mind, if you've got a slight doubt about, hang on, I need to be stopping someone taking a shot here because we're conceding goals from outside the box, just that doubt in your mind creates that mini second of delay that can be the difference between you spotting a run and not spotting a run, or making the right decision and making the wrong one. And, you know, I don't want to pile in on Adrian, but the difference in Liverpool's defending, albeit it hasn't been perfect this season already, looks night and day when he's there and when he's not.
Well, it looks like Alisson won't be there when Liverpool return after the international break, when they'll of course be taking on Everton in the derby. An Everton side who on Saturday continued, of course, their perfect start with a 4-2 win over Brighton. They've started a league season now with 4 wins out of 4 for the first time since the summer of 69, when they went on to win the title. They've won 7 games in a row in all competitions for the first time since April 87, when they also won the title. Are Everton just one goalkeeper away from challenging for the title?
Oh, Jordan, I wouldn't quite go that far yet. I'm still eating humble pie on this podcast. When I was on a few weeks back when they signed James Rodriguez and was asked, you know, about the sense, the good sense in that signing, and I cast some doubt on it and suggested it was probably the worst type of buy that Everton could possibly do. Sort of a go back to the sort of glamour days when they probably needed something very different. Well, I've been proved horribly wrong on that front. I love the balance to the Everton side, and even without Alan playing on Saturday, they've got so much going for them. A lot of creativity now, incision. I mean, they scored 4 past Brighton with Richarlison carrying an injury and departing early. Dominic Calvert-Lewin's utterly untouchable at the moment as well, which helps. But I suspect ultimately they will drop off slightly from their position at the moment, and Jordan Pickford's errors will come into that. I know it was another dreadful goal to concede, the first one in particular, and unfortunately with Jordan Pickford, he's not really offering much reassurance to those centre halves in front of him at the moment. But Everton have got enough firepower to sort of make up for these errors as it stands, and it's great to see. I've always loved Carlo Ancelotti. I just think he's brilliant. He was great to cover when he was at Chelsea, and his eyebrow is just outstanding in itself. So to see that as a happy eyebrow now is great.
50 points between them and Liverpool at the end of last season. Now Everton 3 points clear. That's a 53-point swing. Incredible.
Yeah. They're all down to Jordan.
Well, I think they might not be favourites with the bookmakers ahead of the derby, but when that game comes around, I think you'd have to make them slight favourites, wouldn't you? Given the way they're playing, given the fact that Alisson probably is unlikely to feature. It's and they are scoring goals for fun. They do remind me a little bit at the moment, and obviously it's exceptionally early days. Do remind me a little bit of the Leicester City juggernaut, you know, where you get a team that just has balance. You use the word, Dom, and you have a goal scorer that is untouchable. And then you know, the Mahrez, you just replace him in with James Rodriguez, don't you? There are shades of it. It's obviously only 4 games in, so it seems ridiculous to say it.
But there's no European fixtures, Italian manager.
Exactly. There's a bit of momentum there, and I can see them going on a bit of a run here, Everton. They'll be hard to beat for sure in that derby. It's depth. It's probably the quality of their defenders, I think, is the issue. Mina and Keane, when put under pressure by lively front men that will pin Everton back, I think clever movement can undo them, especially if you've got, you know, Coleman and Digne flying forward. I think they'll leak a lot of goals as the season goes on. But yes, right now they're fantastic.
All right, well, the Merseyside derby will be the first game back when the Premier League returns after the international break. Many more stories to discuss from Sunday and Saturday, so we'll be back with those after this.
We know everyone thinks this season is going to be different, but at Paddy Power, we're staying positive because isn't the new normal just the same old football? Avoid unnecessary journeys. That's Fulham's trip to Anfield off. Self-isolate? Some strikers do that very effectively already. You see? New normal, same old football. And that's why if one leg of your 4-plus-fold Acca lets you down, you get your money back as a free bet on all football matches and all markets. The Acca Cracker from Paddy Power.
Max free bet £10, min odds 1-5 on each leg. Online exclusive, exclude shop bets, T's and C's apply. 18+, begambleaware.org.
on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic. This is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Harry Kane will step up to take the penalty. Remember the scenes. Remember the scoreline. Spurs have six at Manchester United.
Sunday afternoon then, everybody. It was one-way traffic at Old Trafford. Josie and the Pussycats was the line I had for this, in a particularly abject performance from the Red Devils. Down to 10 men, of course, but in deep trouble before Martial got his marching orders. As for Spurs, completing a four-game, 17-goal week with possibly their best performance under Jose Mourinho. This was kind of back to his Porto knee-sliding, suit-ruining golden days, no, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing we know about old Jose is that when he identifies weaknesses in an opponent, particularly an opponent that he has a personal reason to try and better, as well as a professional one, he absolutely delights in doing so. And, you know, Tottenham were excellent. Manchester United made it incredibly easy for them. And that is a result, to my mind, that should have very long, serious, lasting ramifications at Old Trafford. But Tottenham should have been tired. Tottenham fell behind after 1 minute. It was a disastrous start. And yet the response was incredibly measured. You know, it wasn't a panicked response. It wasn't a, we're going to need to fly at Manchester United now. It was a, we know we can beat these. We've worked on their weaknesses. We know what we need to do to swing this game in our favour. And we're going to do all of those things. And that is the definition of a well-coached team. And that's not something I've thought about Mourinho's Tottenham much so far. But it is the antidote of what I've seen in Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's Manchester United.
Right. I mean, from the Spurs' point of view, the view had very much been regarding Mourinho that he'd been a bit left behind by the game. This start of the season seems to say something quite different.
Yeah, I think this was the most impressed I've been with Jose Mourinho for a long, long time. I think this eclipses anything he produced as Manchester United manager. I think he did really, really expose United's weaknesses here. I wrote a piece before the game, actually, just explaining where I thought that they could hurt Manchester United, because they've got two forwards that are playing as the wide forwards, as the wingers, effectively, and they've got two-man midfield, effectively, with Fernandes doing what he likes. And that means if you've got attacking fullbacks, and Spurs have got attacking fullbacks in Reguilón and Aurier in this game, then you can really cause problems. And what happened was Lamela kept dragging Luke Shaw in, and then on the outside, Aurier flew, and we saw the same on the other side. And they just had no real answer to it, Manchester United. That was just one of many problems. That was just a tactical piece of management that Jose nailed on the day. It was magnificent, I thought, from Spurs. Son and Kane, superb. The selection of Ndombele turned out to be a masterstroke. He's really skillful, isn't he? He doesn't always look the part. He looks a bit heavy, but he's got good skill and he caused problems. So yeah, it was very, very clever from Jose. But for me, it was the two forwards, Son and Kane, and those flying fullbacks that did the damage here, coupled, of course, with some truly dreadful football and attitudes from Manchester United's players.
There were some magnificent bits of defending, the Bailey pass, but also the bit when Harry Maguire hauls down, is it Luke Shaw?
Luke Shaw, yeah.
When he's just about to clear. I mean, not that you should laugh or anything, but it was a tremendously entertaining start to the game and became progressively less so for Man United fans. The red card, it wasn't about the red card, but we probably should mention it. When Lamela thrusts an elbow in Martial's face and Martial responds with a bit of a cuff to Lamela's face and then gets shown the red card, Lamela should have gone as well, no?
Personally thought it was a yellow card each, but
yeah.
But I guess if you're sending off Martial, you should probably have a look at the elbow as well, and determine whether that was a red card offence as well. Mm. Otherwise, I just think it makes a bit of mockery with a retaliation, which was petty, it was petulant. But the original offence carried a bit more snarl, I thought.
Yeah, I think that red card, I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer owes Anthony Taylor a pint, really, because it gives him a get-out-of-jail card, really. Because I'm telling you now, Spurs were going to thrash Manchester United, whether it was 11-10 or 11-11. They were all over the gaff, and It's just the attitudes of the players. I thought Luke Shaw's trip on Lucas Moura just summed up where their heads were at. It was a disgrace. It was, I don't care about this anymore. I'm just going to do what I want. And what can anyone do about it? Paul Pogba's tackle for the penalty lost his head. He was also culpable for the goal before. Obviously, we saw, you know, mistakes littered through the game with Bailly and Maguire. But yeah, I just thought that their discipline as a team was non-existent, Manchester United. And that is not a good reflection on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer at all, especially in light of what's happened off the pitch in terms of discipline in recent times, with Harry Maguire getting into trouble, with Mason Greenwood. It just gives that impression that, you know, that they're not doing things properly, that the standards on and off the pitch are slipping there.
Well, Daniel, you were saying that you felt this result would have long-term ramifications. What kind of far-reaching effects do you think should happen? I presume you're not talking about signing up a new left-back and Edinson Cavani from Paris Saint-Germain.
No, I mean, you know, I said exactly the same on the show last weekend after they won, but there are two things at play here. It is both true that the off-field recruitment is appalling, is completely inefficient and is hamstrung by having non-football experts in football expert roles. But, you know, it is also true that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is not the best man for his job. To me, it's incredibly simple. You could ask the supporters, or you could poll the supporters of the 44 or 43 other teams in the Premier League and Championship, and I would be surprised if more than 10 of those clubs majority voted to swap their own manager for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. You know, there are reasons that he is at Manchester United because he has a history, but they don't count for anything anymore. He's been there nearly 2 years and we haven't seen enough improvement. And, you know, they lost to... Today was most disappointing because they effectively lost two matches. They lost it through their own inability to defend and organise themselves in the first half. But at half-time, a good manager or a good coach says to those players, we've lost today, we've got 10 men and we're trailing badly. Now go out and show some resolve and either run down the clock or do something just to puff your chest out a bit. And actually, they had a complete abdication of duty in the second half as well because their heads went and they conceded more goals.
The one development that we do know of this Sunday evening is that Cavani and Alex Telles are apparently doing their medicals. Colm Hall asks, does the pod think that Edinson Cavani will really be an upgrade on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer? It's an interesting angle. Anshuman Joshi says, can we do a flip forward instead of reverse, where Ollie's sacked and Poch is brought in, just so we can simulate United's next 3 years where we again do all, just so we can establish our managerial chopping is futile right now?
I've seen a lot of Manchester United fans saying, what's the point in changing the manager because everything behind the scenes is rotten? And I kind of understand that point. But if you've got five problems, the best solution is surely not to go, well, we're not doing that one, so there's no point fixing any of them. You fix the ones you can, and changing the manager has long in football been the easiest way of doing that. And it can make a huge difference.
Danny, who's in your winners and losers column for Football 365 this Monday morning?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the most emphatic weekends of that column I can remember, if I'm honest.
Really?
Yeah, okay. I mean, bless Wolves Fulham, but it will not be getting a mention.
Okay. Is Cavani's agent in your winners column?
It should be.
Yeah, I mean, I thought a week ago, this has got Manchester United throwing obscene money at players they don't really want all over it. And at least Edinson Cavani is old enough and past it enough that they won't throw obscene money at it other than on the wages. But I honestly believe you could give a football passionate 11-year-old a blank canvas with Manchester United's transfer policy and he would come up with better names than Edinson Cavani. He really would, because it's just, it's remarkable. It really is. It's laughable. It's absolutely laughable.
It's genius forward planning in a way. Obviously, Martial's got a 3-match ban. So in comes Cavani. Happy days.
That is long-term planning the Manchester United way at the moment, isn't it? We cover the next 3 matches. It's staggering. It's staggering that United's answer to Lindelof stroke Bailly stroke Maguire and at centre-half is to bring in a left-back, an ageing striker, and to target a right-winger. I mean, it's just utterly baffling, and nothing will go right at that club, properly go right at that club, until they sort out their recruitment.
When they return, Man United have Newcastle away, then Paris Saint-Germain in the Champions League, and Chelsea So that's going to be interesting. Also, a bit of business. There's going to be a lot of this kind of thing today because the transfer window is closing on this Monday, the 5th of October. But Spurs, in the meantime, have wrapped up both a new striker and also one of the best signing announcement social media posts in recent memory as Vinicius joins Jose Mourinho's side. A side buoyed by an extraordinary 6-1 win at Old Trafford. Of course, you have to be careful not to get too excited over one victory, as last weekend's shock winners in Manchester, Leicester, demonstrated themselves this weekend just how different things can be only 1 week later. We'll have a look at Leicester and their performance against West Ham next.
Listeners, we want to tell you about Scoot, the new lift sharing app for friends who love football. Scoot connects teammates who drive with teammates looking for a lift. So whether that's a trip to training, a five-a-side kickabout in the park, or a visit to the pub to watch Super Sunday, Scoot auto-calculates the costs, splits the fares, and collects the money via the app so there's no haggling or chasing cash. Scoot is also 80% cheaper than ride-hailing or taxis, and especially these days, isn't it nicer to share a car with no more than five of your mates than get on a bus with strangers? Download Scoot today on Android or iPhone and get £15 worth of free rides and drives as soon as you install it. Even better, if you send an email to help@scootride.com saying The Athletic sent you, you'll get an additional £5 after your first drive or ride. Go on, get your boots out of the boot with Scoot, the Totally Football Shows and The Athletic. That's Scoot, S-K-O-O-T, the new lift sharing app for friends who love football. You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power.
Start of Sunday seems a long time ago to us here on Sunday evening, but back then, listener, West Ham's 3-0 defeat of Leicester at the King Power Stadium seemed like the shock of shocks this season, sending the Hammers zooming up the table with another clean sheet, and a rare away win. Neymar Butlins writes in, asking, can the panel explain the success of West Ham? Moy should receive some credit, particularly considering that he's doing this without the help of Marouane Fellaini. Well, the best man to explain what's going on with West Ham is Totally's West Ham man, Benji Laniardo, who earlier on today we found relaxing post-game in his dressing gown. Benji, this isn't the post a 4-0 against Wolves and a 3-0 against Leicester conversation I was expecting.
It's very weird. What the hell is going on? Two really fantastic performances in a row against great teams. And this one was almost flawless. It was incredible.
When was the last time you saw West Ham playing this well, in all seriousness?
Ooh, I don't know. It's very different. I mean, the most enjoyable football that we've had in recent years was the Bilic season with Payet. This is a very different type of team. We're sort of slightly more rugged and we worked incredibly hard. And actually, the thing... I'm going to say it. We've got to give David Moyes quite a lot of credit. And, you know, there are jokes being made that, you know, the difference is he's currently working from home. Well, actually, the difference is the change is that he's made. We've changed formation to a sort of 3-4-3. And that really has been the main difference over the last couple of games.
It's been a remarkable series of performances. Fornals' first touch, a player that I think many West Ham fans might have regarded as a slightly mysterious object, but a wonderful performance today. Who were your standout players in the Leicester game?
Oh, I mean, across the board, I thought we were exceptional. I think it's really smart moving Masuaku to the left because as long as he has absolutely no defensive responsibility whatsoever, he's great. And Fornals was amazing. He's sort of flattered to deceive since he arrived last year. And his first touch to bring the ball down for his goal was sublime. Rice was superb in the middle. He sort of really set our tempo. He gave Leicester's more dangerous players so little space. And actually, I think one of the reasons that there's so many admiring glances in his direction is that he provides really quick, dangerous transitions for us. He started the move that led to the third goal. Ogbonna Varo, like really incredible against Vardy the whole game. You know, he's just got back into the Italy squad, which I think has gone slightly unnoticed. And again, Antonio. Jimbo, am I mad in thinking that he should be part of the England conversation? Because genuinely, we don't have anyone else like him up front. You know, he's like a sort of more durable version of Andy Carroll in that when he's on form, he's really hard to stop. And, you know, he could be a one-man plan B for England, but maybe that's getting carried away.
I'm not going to argue with you, Benji. If it's not David Moyes' absence, hashtag banter, is it a coincidence that all this has happened with Mark Noble suddenly out of the team?
Well, Jimbo, you watch your mouth. No, I mean, seriously, no, it's probably not a coincidence. And, you know, this team is a real meritocracy now. And if we're only playing two centre mids, then he'd probably be the first to admit that he doesn't get in the team. You know, Suchek and Rice are playing fantastically. And again, you know, Moyes, to his credit, is pretty pragmatic with his stuff. We had £100 million worth of attacking talent on the bench in Allaire, in Anderson, Yarmolenko. But our front three was, you know, a converted winger in Antonio, a bloke we signed from Hull, and Pablo Fornals. And, you know, because all of them work their asses off, and Moyes likes that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think Noble may well now be, by default, on the bench and coming on, you know, in cup games at the end of games to close them down. So, yeah, I think it's not a coincidence.
Mm. Benjamin, you think back to the conversation we had on the eve of the season and then that defeat against Newcastle, the position you thought West Ham were going to be in right now. What's been the biggest surprise about this run of results?
I think we've just looked like a proper football team. Like, you know, there were times, you know, immediately post lockdown and then at the beginning of this season where it was very difficult to get a sense of any kind of identity at West Ham. And that's been a problem really since we got to the Olympic Stadium. You know, what the hell is West Ham? What do we do? What's our thing? And these last two games, we've looked really coherent. We've worked incredibly hard. You know, we were gegenpressing at times in this game today. Wolves and Leicester are the kind of teams that I was looking at with deep jealousy at the beginning of this season. And, you know, and then Everton after they picked up a whole new midfield. Because, it felt like they're the kind of teams that West Ham should be competing with, but were nowhere near. And, yeah, two games in a row, we've absolutely mullered them. Seven goals and conceded none. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. All right, David Moyes back in the dugout when the international break ends, just in time to face Spurs, Man City and then Liverpool. Can the miracle continue, Benji?
It doesn't matter because we've got points in the bag now. In the Uncle Jeff coefficient, we're on +6. We didn't the equivalent fixtures last year,
yes.
We lost our first seven. And we obviously didn't beat Wolves at home last year. We didn't beat Leicester away last year. So yeah, we've got points to spare, Jimbo.
All right then. Well, you enjoy your post-match glow in your kimono, and we'll catch up with you again soon, Benji.
Cheers, Jimbo.
Benji Lagnado. Adrian, you've been writing about West Ham.
Yeah, ahead of this game, I was talking about their aerial power. You said David Moyes is doing it without Marouane Fellaini, but he is doing it with Thomas Suchek, who is basically Fellaini reincarnated at times because of he makes those marauding runs into the box from central midfield and wins almost every header. And of course, when you've got him and Mikel Antonio, it means you have serious aerial power. And that, I think, is a big plus for West Ham at the moment because they've got good crosses. And we saw that with Aaron Cresswell, double assist in this game. And in the game against Arsenal a couple of weeks back, I was watching that one closely. And they whipped so many great balls into the box. It was causing chaos. And ahead of this weekend, they'd had the most accurate crosses in the Premier League of any team. So I think that is worth mentioning. And as is the fact that they went to Emirates Stadium and outshot Arsenal massively. I can't remember the exact stats. I think West Ham might have had 21 efforts. That rings a bell to almost double Arsenal. They had 14 shots in this game against Leicester and only four against them. I mean, that's not fluky. They've got something about them. They're playing with aggression now and they've got better legs. And by legs, I mean they've got athleticism in the middle of the park. And it's no slight on Mark Noble, who's been a great player, but Suchek and Rice are a really good combination.
They're a better side now than they were last season, aren't they, by some distance. And last season was they really, really underachieved. I mean, they shouldn't have been in the relegation scrap that they found themselves in for most of that campaign. They've tapped into the sort of Czech connection with some of their signings, as Suchek one mentioned, Kufal as well. It sounds as if they're going to be quite active on deadline day to try and bring in the centre half, which maybe even the knowledge that one might be incoming has given the likes of Ogbonna and Balbuena a bit of a kick up the backside as well. I thought if you gave Moyes time and resources, he would still do a really good job for a club like West Ham. I just think that's when he's in his element with that type of player and you get the industry, get them all working together and organise, as Adrian says. And even in his absence in the last couple of games, you can see that is Moyes' plan that's in evidence there.
What about Leicester? Is it when they're not given penalties they struggle?
To an extent, I think that might be true. Because we raved and I raved about Jamie Vardy scoring three goals with 21 touches, but they might like Jamie Vardy to have a few more touches than that, and they barely had a shot on target, I don't think, against West Ham. Hmm. Just the disallowed goal. I think they badly miss. I mean, they didn't, slightly ironically, against Manchester City, but they badly miss Wilfred Ndidi and always have, quite frankly. They badly miss Ricardo Pereira and always will, because I think he's behind Trent Alexander-Arnold. He's the best attacking right back in the league. And the reality is that squad isn't big enough to cope with those kind of absentees. And I'm actually quite surprised that Brendan Rodgers has been, I mean, maybe he's doing it behind the scenes, but I'm quite surprised that he hasn't asked for a little bit more from the owners this summer, because they obviously slumped badly towards the end of last season, and this still felt like a good chance to kick on. And it kind of feels like they've missed the boat a little bit on that. Results like this happen. We say it about Liverpool, we say it about Leicester. But yeah, this kind of performance where they're both abject in both ends of the pitch and lacking in midfield is a little bit worrying.
Now, elsewhere on Sunday, Arsenal had a 2-1 win at home to Sheffield United. Can you sum this up for us in one word, Adrian?
Efficient.
Okay. Wolves had a 1-0 win over Fulham, which possibly you would award the same epithet. Still waiting for a reaction from Tony Khan to that defeat. Fulham, of course, adding Ademola Lookman to their squad, and he impressed, I think. Did anyone watch this game, the Wolves-Fulham game? Was that you, Dom?
That was me, yeah. That was I got given the one goal affair.
Crikey.
Now, Lookman was superb when he came on. I mean, he only came on for the last half hour or so, but he's got such quick feet, and he did spread a bit of panic. And up to that point, it had been very much Fulham had been working so hard to try and be as organised and defensively sure as they could possibly be after their, you know, horribly slapdash start to the season. And with two left-footed centre-halves in Le Marchand and Ream, they'd actually done a decent job of it. OK, they conceded the goal and then they're chasing the game, but they'd offered nothing going forward at all. So it was finding that balance between being defensively assured and offering a bit of an attacking threat. And Lookman, thankfully, did do that, inject a bit of pace and creation in the last 20 minutes, half an hour. And they're probably a bit unlucky to come away with a defeat. But Wolves just look a team that's in transition at the moment, trying to work out who actually plays for them and who doesn't anymore. I mean, it's a very strange sort of situation with them, but sort of bedding in a lot of new signings. And I mean, they'll be fine. They'll tear it up over the second half of the season, I imagine. But at the moment, they look a bit unfamiliar with each other.
Fulham's neighbours down the bottom end, West Brom, meanwhile, were defeated 2-0 by Southampton. Aurier Romeo contributing a remarkable volley with the first touch he's had in the opposition box this season. Adrian, were there other things that you had wanted to tell us about the Arsenal performance beyond efficiency?
I'd like to explain why I use the word efficient. And that's because they only had six shots and they scored two really good goals. Six shots.
It's not as efficient as Newcastle, is it?
No, not quite, no. But only six shots at home to Sheffield United isn't a great stat. And it's another reason to question their creativity as a side. It's definitely a work in progress there. It was an uninspired performance, but the two goals were really good to watch, really good. And they were very Arteta in the way that they were constructed. There was good rotational movement. And Pepe, I think, was probably the... Pepe and Bellerin were the stars of the show. Bellerin was really good, two assists. And Pepe, who came off the bench, just lifted everybody. And I think in a team that's lacking a creator at the moment, and Arsenal are sorely lacking a creator, I think they've got to find a place for Nicola Pepe. Because even though he can be frustrating, because he can do things that others can't. He can beat a player and open up the pitch. And that's what he did in this game. And he scored what I think might become a trademark goal, driving in from the right, bending it into the far corner. So, yeah, good day for him, but quite a forgettable match.
OK, then, we'll move on. Saturday's other stories await us on the other side of this.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Who's up for a sparkling afternoon at Elland Road as Leeds took on Manchester City? Manchester City, of course, last season when they had their first league defeat, they went out and won their next league game 8-0. And the way this game started at Elland Road, it looked like they might be after something similar. They were magnificent to begin with, no?
Yeah, they were. There's a really interesting thing with City is that generally they when they have dropped points, they've fallen into a pattern, which is that when they score first, they win games and they go on to dominate teams. And when they concede first, it causes this mass panic that we spoke about, particularly after, you know, at the end of last season. But this season, they've already dropped 5 points from games in which they've scored first. Now, that's as many points as they dropped when scoring first in the whole of 2017-18 when they won the title first under Pep. And I think under Pep, they haven't dropped more than 9 points when scoring first in games in the Premier League. So it's kind of weird that they found a new way to be defensively lax, which is this really commanding start, as against Wolves, as against Leicester, as against Leeds on Saturday. And then they just seem to... It used to be that they conceded a goal and it caused this mass panic in defence. Now it feels like a team just has one go at them and makes one run and they have this mass panic in defence. So, yeah, very odd. But the one thing I want to say about this game, and it's not really a kind of... It's almost anti-analysis, but the last half an hour in which both sides were just trading blows with each other was just... To me, that is Premier League football at its absolute best. That kind of really intense, really harem-scarem kind of basketball football was just a genuine pleasure to watch. And talk about Guardiola and Bielsa as these kind of tactical behemoths, but... tactical has somehow become a sort of euphemism for stalemate a little bit. Actually, it can just produce this fantastic, weird, chaotic football that is absolutely sensational to watch.
Mm. Blake Redding, wondering to what extent Bielsa's performance, or at least Leeds' performance with Bielsa in the opening game of the season for them against Liverpool, has set the tone for other teams knowing how to compete now against the likes of Klopp, or in this case, Guardiola. I mentioned the dominance, though, that Man City had at the start of this match, going a goal up and then Kevin De Bruyne hitting the post as well. How did Leeds turn it around?
Do you know what? I thought that Marcelo Bielsa here had a great feel for the game. And by that, I just think he could see what was needed at the right time. And they began... They were a little bit too respectful, I thought, of City early on in the game. And they upped the aggression and they really got after City. And then what he did, he brought Pervada underneath to really have a go at Mendy. And I thought that was very, very clever, as was the timing of the Rodrigo substitution. I felt that at that point, Leeds were ready for that second forward to get up there and join in with Bamford to really... Put a slightly creaking City defence under massive pressure, and Rodrigo himself really grasped that opportunity. He was everywhere, very, very positive, and was a big goal threat. So yeah, I feel that Bielsa sort of had a good taste, a good smell for the game, and made the right changes at the right time. So much so that in the end, Pep had to react and go a little bit more cautious right towards the end, just to make sure they got a point.
What about the defensive issues that you mentioned, Daniel? Last defeat saw them go out and buy another defender. Presumably they're not going to do that on this Monday. I know Richard Keyes' excited comment with his proposal that they bring in Sam Allardyce on a part-time basis, but genuinely, is there something that needs to be done if they're to turn around a season which currently has them, I think, lying 14th in the league?
No, I mean... That I know that wasn't a joke suggestion from Richard Keyes, but it was a joke suggestion from Richard Keyes. I don't think so. I mean, I know defensive coaches are a thing, and City have some coaches who specialise more in the defensive aspects of game than the attacking. I just think it's a mental issue. You know, we've talked about this time and time again with City. It's about concentrating all the time. And when your team is relentlessly attacking in the first 15 minutes, I can imagine as a defender, it's quite easy to switch off to those runs in behind. And I don't think it's any surprise that Jamie Vardy was one of those players who really got at them, because he is an incredibly hardworking and a kind of pest striker who will look for your deficiencies and exploit them. That has to improve, or they simply won't win the league, whatever Liverpool's result this weekend.
Mm. As for Leeds, though, there was so much excitement about seeing Marcelo Bielsa and his football in the Premier League. And so far, they've not disappointed in any way. It's fabulous with them, the likes of Villa, turned into this kind of rampaging attacking side. It is, whilst there are major asterisks about many aspects of this campaign, it is a pretty unique sporting spectacle so far.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, I remember Norwich last season going to Anfield on the opening weekend. I think it was Friday night, and going all out attack and getting absolutely, well, just 4-0 down at half time. I think it was just because they were picked off so easily on the break. Leeds have a bit more guile, a bit more edge to them. There's certainly a lot more nous to them. They know exactly what they're doing. They're well drilled, and they are thrilling to watch. And we shouldn't be surprised, really. I mean, this is what Bielsa does. I'm interested to see how long they can sustain it at this tempo. Can they do this into the spring? But everything about them so far is refreshing, and it's brilliant to see them back, and long may it continue.
On that, Dom, I looked into their running stats ahead of the game, and it was interesting because obviously we know that Bielsa's side are known for being super fit. So I asked our pals at Opta, are they? And yes, they were number one for distance covered. Manchester City, by contrast, and not this isn't a slight on them because everyone has a different style, they were ranked 17th. Before that game, Leeds had covered over 8 kilometres per game more than Manchester City, which I thought was a huge number, a really huge number. And that is the reason that Leeds are going to make life really hard for everyone that they play this season, because they are relentless in their off-the-ball application as well as their runs when they have it. So, yeah, they're going to be a nightmare to play all season. You've got to ready yourself for a test against Leeds.
The other weird thing, and it's a bit of a hypothesis rather than, you know, I don't offer any proof necessary for this, but I wonder if the way Leeds play might almost render their opponents meaningless, in that they will certainly play the same way as against Manchester City, as against West Bromwich Albion. But I almost wonder if it might yield the same results. So they almost might have a season where they get just about as many points against the top half as they do the bottom half, because it feels like if what they do works to the full extent, they will be successful. And if what they do doesn't work, they won't be successful. Clearly, they will more likely to be punished by better teams and better attackers. But I wonder if there might be a bit of a kind of mesh about how they perform against teams across the league. That will be proven completely horribly wrong over the next few weeks, of course.
Well, we'll see. I mean, bets have never been more off, I think, than in this current campaign. City, though, set new standards for excellence not that long ago, a little bit more than a kind of year and a half ago, the 2018-19 campaign. How is it that they've gone from that to this admittedly spectacular but ultimately deeply flawed outfit?
I don't like giving them this excuse because they have an extraordinary amount of money with which to buy replacement players, but they've been without Sergio Aguero for a fair while. They've been without Aymeric Laporte for long, long periods. And I honestly believe if you swapped around Aymeric Laporte and Virgil van Dijk, those two clubs would have had the other club's season last season. That's how much better I think Virgil van Dijk is than Aymeric Laporte's replacement. So I hate giving City that excuse because they have got so much money to buy new players. But I don't think we can overlook just how much that Laporte and Aguero absence makes a difference. And Leroy Sané last season as well, albeit a player didn't really want to be there.
Right. And the conversion, or at least the accuracy of their shots, the incredible number of shots in this game, 35 in total. City had 23, but only 2 of them on target, which might be in some way relevant or related to the absence of both Gabriel Jesus and Sergio Aguero. Though, Daniel, you're frowning.
No. I agree. I mean, they play this kind of false nine formation in which someone is normally picked as a striker. It doesn't do it. But that false nine normally relies on other people getting ahead of them. City almost don't do that. They're almost completely strikerless. So against a good defence, that can occasionally just lead to you not having enough men in the box and having to shoot from distance, which Sterling did brilliantly. But I suspect that those 23 shots, I suspect plenty of them were from long range or outside the box, because it just feels like they don't really get enough players close to the ball when they don't have Gabriel Jesus or Aguero starting.
Well, if you had to drop points against anybody, I'm sure Pep would be delighted that it's to Marcelo Bielsa. And when you look at the other results which came afterwards, City got off lightly in this craziest of weekends. Very shortly, we'll be looking at Chelsea's 4-0 win over Crystal Palace, and also, yes, Newcastle Burnley. First of all, though, it's our friend Lee Price with some odds from Paddy Power.
Hello, everyone. Wow, this weekend was a lot. I don't know if there are any Man United fans still listening, or yes, indeed, any fans, full stop, etc., boom, boom. But I want to give you a little reprieve here. And no, it's not to tell you about Edson Cavani or that other lad that I've only ever seen on Football Manager. I actually want to give you 5 seconds of soothing sounds to escape from all the critique and chaos. Ah, there you go. Now, back to remembering Phil Jones and Marcus Rojo still play for your club. I do have to do some actual odds, apologies, and rather than tell you that Solskjaer is a new favourite in the sack race, oops, me in my mouth, I thought maybe I'd focus on some of the positive stories in the Premier League to distract you from this carnage. So here we go. Leeds United are odds on to finish in the top half of the table, as millions of lads who couldn't be bothered to watch a Championship last season realise they're quite good. And an English team, Manchester City, are joint favourites to win the Champions League this season. So there you go, United fans. I'm sure that will really perk you up. All the best.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Dominic.
The Dom Fifield Derby.
It was the Dominic Fifield Derby this weekend, as Chelsea welcomed Crystal Palace to Stamford Bridge. Were you present?
No, thankfully.
Okay. What did you make of it from a safe distance? First of all, big win for Frank's new look Blues, no? Eduardo Mendy, the keeper, Thiago Silva looking better, and Ben Chilwell, what a debut.
Yeah, they did well, and it was much needed. It was much needed because the pressure was starting to mount on him, to be honest. They clicked after half-time. I think they probably went in frustrated at 0-0 at half-time and thought, here we go again, and Palace could pick them off on the break. But actually, their performance throughout was dominant in a... I thought the player of the match was actually Zouma. And the way that he did such a good stifling job on Wilfred Zaha really prevented Palace doing what they'd done, say, at Old Trafford earlier this season, where Palace was such a threat on the counter-attack. Here, Zaha just didn't get on the ball and Zouma was all over him, completely dominant. When you've got a Chilwell doing that down his side and having the same effect on Andros Townsend and Azpilicueta's sort of experience and know-how negating Eberechi Eze on the left, it just gave them this great platform to wait for Palace to make a mistake. And the way, because Palace just couldn't get out of their own half, that mistake came and Saka actually made three of them in the end. So it ended up being a very, very comfortable win. You know, you could argue that it's a deceptive 4-0 win, but actually I thought Chelsea were completely in control from the start.
Good weekend for Zoomers, you know, with David Moyes.
Very good.
The other good thing for Chelsea's perspective, and Lampard will very much sell the positives of this, is that Timo Werner's had 11 shots and hasn't scored, looks a little bit like he's kind of finding his way in. Kai Havertz has only had 6 touches of the ball in the penalty area so far, which is far fewer than Lampard would like. But they're getting their goals from odd areas. You know, Kurt Zouma's already scored twice. Reece James is their highest chance creator. Jorginho, obviously on penalties, is the top scorer. Ben Chilwell scored on Saturday. So they are getting goals from players they wouldn't necessarily expect to get them from, which is basically completely rendering the discussion, or at least any kind of emergency discussion about how long it will take the front line to gel, null and void. Because while they're winning games, Lampard can avoid those questions.
On the subject of Timo Werner, Duncan Alexander pointing out that he has now waited 2 hours longer than Joe Ellington did for his first Premier League goal, and counting in brackets.
Yeah, naughty. He's looked sharp, I think. But I was going to ask Dom, actually, about Werner and what you think might happen. Because he's comfortable on the left, operating there, because he makes those runs inside. I think he will get into goal-scoring positions. But we know that when he's fit, surely Christian Pulisic will be the left winger, because he was dynamite before he got injured, sensational in the cup final and before that moment. So will Werner play as the striker with Havertz behind, or do you think that Werner will flick to the other side and be the wide right guy?
No, because I think that's where Hakan Ziyech will end up, and he hasn't featured at all yet. So no, yeah, I think you're right. I think there is a complicated selection issue there, and thankfully Frank Lampard has that many games still to play with, given the Champions League, etc., that he will have to chop and change, because Werner will end up as a central striker I imagine, in his first choice 11. But where does that leave Tammy Abraham? Where does that leave Olivier Giroud? I mean, Giroud's probably on the way out at the end of the season, you'd imagine. I think you're right about Havertz as a 10. Then you've got to fit Ziyech in and Pulisic in, and then where does his favourite player Mason Mount fit in? I mean, it's a proper dilemma for them. But that's what happens when you just accumulate a squad full of creative midfielders. You have to loan the likes of Ross Barkley out just to ensure that, you know, you haven't got seven of them on the bench. It's exciting to have all those options, and it will take them time to work out their best 11. That's often used as a sort of criticism. The manager doesn't know his best 11, but actually it's probably a position they'd all like to be in because it means they've got options.
Mm, very true. Jorginho, who's still being linked by transfer rumours to Arsenal. Of course, by now that may or may not have happened. Listeners, you hear this. Let's conclude our roundup of round four of this Premier League season with Newcastle's 3-1 win over Burnley.
Yeah, not a good day for Nick Pope to have a wobble, that's for sure. With Jordan Pickford having his own issues at Everton, I think he could have done with a much better performance right from the start. He looked edgy. And with Dean Henderson on the bench for Manchester United, it does make you wonder what Gareth Southgate's going to do moving forward. Look, Newcastle were good value. I was surprised at Burnley and how easy they were to carve open. But maybe we shouldn't be surprised because they're so reliant on me and Tarkowski. And I quite fancied them to get something from this game because Tarkowski was back. But look, it's only one half of the double act, isn't it? And I think that those two players are absolutely the heartbeat of that Claret side. And when one or both aren't there, they seem to be quite easy fodder for the rest of the division.
They look stretched, don't they, Burnley, at the moment? They just have a feel of a club that needed to do more in this transfer window. I think that'll clearly be a source of issues between the management and the ownership over the months to come if they don't do a lot of business on transfer deadline day, or indeed by the end of next week when the domestic transfer window closes, because they need freshening up in a lot of areas. They can't rely on McNeil just to be their creative force pushing them forward. They can't rely on Tarkowski at the back because he's a player that has been unsettled by the transfer rumours that have swirled around him all summer. So they need something. They need an injection from somewhere.
Newcastle, with their signings, in fact, looking revitalised. Callum Wilson with a brace and Sam Maximan back in the side with a goal and an assist.
Yeah, a word too for Joe Linton, who has become a bit of a running joke because he costs £40 million and doesn't score goals. Anyone that watched him in Germany would say he is far better on the left or even the right of a front three, kind of holding up the ball from there and linking play. And lo and behold, Newcastle finally sign an actual number nine, and he is pushed out on the left and or on the right as he was against Burnley. He kind of nominally starts as a striker, but is now able to drift really well and is hard to pick up doing that. Wilson misses chances, but he also makes those runs that no other Newcastle player makes. And they look 10 times the side, as well as Joe Linton looking 10 times a player, because they've finally got competition for places. You know, Ryan Fraser and Miguel Almiron weren't starting on Saturday. And yeah, there is some reason for optimism, I think, at Newcastle.
Mm, they're up in the top half of the table, a point ahead of resurgent West Ham. Of course, very, very early days. The Premier League takes a break now as the Nations League resumes play. And Thursday's Totally Football Show will give you everything you need to enjoy or indeed avoid the international games coming up over the next week or so. Before that, also out today, there's a Totally Football League show, which, Daniel, we won't have too much time to discuss what's happened in the Football League this weekend.
Shame.
Bristol City, though, are top of the table with 4 wins out of 4. At the other end, of course, Nottingham Forest. Tuesday, look out for the Totally Scottish Football show, which will probably feature some news on Kilmarnock, whose entire squad is self-isolating after multiple COVID-19 diagnoses. And the Totally Football Show European edition will be out slightly later on Tuesday, discussing all sorts of huge stories, not least the game which didn't take place in Italy Sunday night, Juventus-Napoli. Juve turned up at their stadium. Napoli remained in Naples. and there's a bit of a row going on. We'll have also a forensic breakdown of the Champions League draw and much more in Tuesday's European edition of the Totally Football Show, so do join us for that. That pretty much wraps it up for this quite an uneventful edition of the Totally Football Show. Many apologies if we didn't cover all of the games in all their glory, but, you know, there was stuff going on. But many, many thanks to Adrian, to Dominic and to Daniel for summing things up, for providing us with sizzling hot takes, with the final whistle having barely blown at Villa Park, and producer Charlie for chopping out all the dodgy bits. And listener, you for being with us. We'll be back soon. From all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of The Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on The Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
Muddy Knees Media.